Welcome to the Lab Medicine Podcast. My name is Hui Fan, and I am currently an assistant professor in transfusion medicine and apheresis in the Department of Pathology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. So this is the first part of the podcast series discussing some of the common indications for emergent apheresis procedure that you might get a call to come in to do it in the middle of the night. Specifically, over the next couple of podcasts, we will discuss the common emergent indication for therapeutic plasma exchange, for red cell exchange, and for leukapheresis procedures. Those are the three procedures that you are most likely to get called in for emergent. I am very happy to have with me today Dr. Duang Lei, who is an attending in pediatrics at the Dignity Health Dominican Hospital in Santa Cruz, California. Together with me, Dr. Lee will present a case, and we will discuss how we handle it together as if it is an emergent indication for apheresis procedure.
Well, thank you, Dr. Pham, for inviting me to discuss with you a case I currently have. So briefly, MT is a very cute, previously healthy 5-year-old male who initially presented to our ED with intermittent fevers, fatigue, and abdominal pain. Interestingly, he also complained of some blurry vision as well as some mild headaches. Parents denied any recent infections, insect bites, or travel history. On exam, he appeared well but had positive petechiae on his arms and legs as well as splenomegaly. The workup was significant for a white count of 370,000, hemoglobin of 6, and a platelet of 20. His CT of the head was normal, and the LP studies were also normal. Infectious and autoimmune workup was also negative. He was then subsequently admitted to the pediatric floor under hemon care for probable diagnosis of AML.
Well, Dr. Lee, briefly, it seemed that your patient are having a very acute illness, and he was recently diagnosed with acute leukemia. And because he had blurry vision, mild headache, it seemed that he had some symptom of leukostasis. Dr. Lee, usually beside the sign and symptom of leukostasis, as you say, in this patient, he has headache and blurry vision. Typically, at what white cell count level do you typically see them to happen clinically in your practice?
Other signs and symptoms of leukostasis include hypoxia as well as dyspnea, which indicates pulmonary complications. And then you can also see signs of DIC on labs. With my experience, these often occur when leukostasis is greater than 400,000 in ALL, and in AML, it occurs or white counts beyond 100,000. As you can see, this patient has symptoms of leukostasis from his high white count. We looked at his smear, and it seems that the leukemic cells are myeloid in origin. We have sent them a sample to the flow lab, and they were run in the morning. At this time, we would like to request emergent leukapheresis for this patient.
Well, Dr. Lee, I agree with you that this patient might benefit from emergent leukapheresis procedure for a couple of reasons. First of all, he has signs and symptoms of leukostasis, headache, and blurry vision, as well as he had a very high white count. So if we acutely lower the WBC, we can hopefully help with the procedure. As you may also know, that the American Society for Apheresis, shortly named as called ASFA, they published a guideline every 3 years. In this guideline, apheresis experts from different fields of medicine, such as transfusion medicine and hematology and nephrology, they come together and they review the literature and they categorize the disease that may be treated by apheresis into four types or four categories. Category 1 contains a disease that apheresis is a first-line therapy. For example, TTP and plasma exchange. Category 2 have the disease that apheresis is only the second-line therapy and should only be used if the first-line therapy fails or is contraindicated. For example, photopheresis in the treatment of the GVHD, graft-versus-host disease, after bone marrow transplant, it is category 2. And should only be tried if the first-line therapy, like immunosuppressive, have been failed. Category 3 indication is used for disease where the risk and the benefit of apheresis should be decided for each patient. Most of the disease in the ASFA guideline are in this category. And CARI-4 is used for the disease where apheresis research have been shown to be ineffective or harmful. ASFAR guideline also provide a grade of recommendation based on the evidence level, either strong or weak for its indication. So I checked the guideline. According to the most recent guideline published in 2013, leukapheresis for symptomatic leukostasis is a first-line, is a CARI-1 indication with strong recommendation based on the moderate quality of evidence. So this patient has symptomatic leukostasis. Therefore, it's a true CARI-1 indication for emergent procedure. Before we start leukapheresis for your patient, we need to discuss several technical aspects that we as a team, me and your pediatric team should consider in order to, for this patient to undergo a safe procedure. So without an access, we cannot do the procedure. And because this patient is pediatric, so the size of the access will depend on the weight of the patient. So do you know the weight of this patient?
Yeah, so MT is 17 kilos.
Because as you might know, apheresis patients require a very high rate, flow rate. Therefore, we need a double lumen vast cath or dialysis catheter type of thing, not a weak central venous catheter. We need a very strong vast cath to withstand the pressure of the flow rate. And there are a couple of publications based on the weight. So based on his 17 kilo weight, we will recommend a femoral line. It will either be 8 or 9 French double lumen. We prefer the bigger line. So we usually recommend femoral line for emergency procedure because it is fast and easy. Because if you put in a neckline, you will have to do a chest x-ray. That might hold up for the procedure. And plus, this is only a one-time treatment, hopefully. So after we finish the procedure, you can put out the femline. Hopefully, you guys can put in a 9 French double lumen vast cath for us to start the procedure. And the next thing we need to consider is the extracorporeal blood volume because of the pediatric patient. And in order to do that, we need to know the patient hematocrit. Dr. Lee, what's the patient hematocrit?
Yeah, so this morning his hematocrit is 25.
Yeah, so as you know, that there is one machine that's FDA approved for indication to do leukapheresis. This time, it's in the Corp Spectra. And for leukapheresis, the extracorporeal volume, the blood volume that is inside the machine and outside the patient at a given point is high for leukapheresis. It's 285 milliliter for the extracorporeal volume, and for the extracorporeal red cell volume, it's 114 milliliter. Usually, most institutions, it's not universal, that most institutions will prime the machine if either the extracorporeal volume or the red cell volume is more than 15% of the patient's total blood volume and the red cell mass. With a weight of 17 kilo and a crit of 25%, his total blood volume is approximately 1,200 milliliter, and the red cell mass is about 300 milliliter. So both of them will exceed 15% if we put this patient on the machine with a leukapheresis kit. Therefore, we need to prime the machine with the red blood cell.
Well, would that acutely increase the viscosity of his blood? Given his current symptoms, we would not like to further increase the viscosity, thus making him more symptomatic.
Well, Dr. Lee, that is a very good point that because these cells are myeloid in origin, they are very big and very sticky. And with even added more red cell, concentrated red cell, we can increase the viscosity. That might cause more symptoms of a headache and blurry vision. But again, this is the risk versus the benefit. Without priming the machine, it's an unsafe procedure to perform because he might develop hypotension and he might have decrease in oxygen carrying capacity. We can adversely affect the brain, the heart, and other organs more. So, we do not want to transfuse a red cell prior to the procedure to increase its hematocrit so we can safely do the procedure. We can prime the machine with the red blood cell unit. And then as we draw out his blood into the machine, we will put in some red cell. Some sender, because of the increase in the viscosity problem, they might even dilute the red cell that they use to prime the machine with albumin to obtain about the end product up about 30%, and they use that product to brand the machine. And some center just brand the machine with a unit directly obtained from the blood bank with a hematocrit of about 60%. Is it not a universal way to all consensus on how to do it? For this patient, because he's already symptomatic with a very high white count, we can go ahead and mix half albumin and half red cell to obtain a hematocrit of about 30% and use that product to prime our machine to make sure that we won't, number one, acutely increase the viscosity of his blood, and number two, we won't cause any hypotension or decrease in the oxygen carrying capacity for him.
So given so much fluid change, do we really need to worry about his blood pressure during the procedure? His normal BP range is 80s over 50s.
Yeah, this is like another really good genuine concern that you have for your patient. As you know that right now in his blood, the white cell count composed the majority of his blood volume, because with such a high white count and a very low crit and a very low platelet, the white count is composed a major significant portion. So if we remove the white cell count, he might run into the risk of circulatory collapse because we remove a significant chunk of his blood volume. Usually for adults, we only need to use normal saline as needed to maintain his blood pressure throughout the procedure. However, for pediatric patients, we need to be a little bit more careful about how much we remove at the end of the procedure, and we need to make sure that the amount of fluid or the amount of white cell we remove at the end of the procedure does not exceed 15% of his total blood volume. We will need to do a very careful fluid balance calculation to make sure that we will not remove more than 15%. So how do we do the fluid balance? We will involve the amount of citrate we give throughout the procedure, because you know that we need to give some citrate to make sure that his blood doesn't clot the machine. So we will calculate based on the citrate rate we give during the procedure. We will know how much we give by the end of the procedure. We also need to see how much we remove by the end of the procedure. And then after you put in all the parameter into the machine, they will tell you the predicted volume of the bag that we remove. And then based on those two, the in and the out, you can predict how much of fluid you need to give. And usually for pediatric, we prefer to use albumin only as needed to maintain the blood pressure, because as you know that albumin is only intravascular, and saline is both intravascular and extravascular. So we will use albumin only to maintain his blood pressure. And we do not give him rings back, because if we rinse back, we will rinse back whatever in the machine back to him at the end of the procedure. That's not usually good, because we will give him back whatever the sum of the white cell that we collect in the machine. And then we also run the risk of a fluid overload, because that would be an extra 300 cc.
Okay, so we would like to reduce the white count by at least 50%. Can you achieve that with your procedure?
Leukapheresis is not an exact science. We will typically perform about 2 blood volume, and we expect with this amount of blood we process, we usually remove by 30-60% of the white cell count pre-procedure by the end of the procedure. And that is our expectation for a good leukapheresis procedure. And Dr. Lee, because as you know that the platelet is also live very close to the buffy coat, that is the layer that we target to remove during our procedure. So we will predict that we will remove some platelet, and we know that for sure we can remove up to 50% of the platelet during a procedure. With this, we are really worrying that he might run the risk of bleeding intracranially if his platelet count is low to start with. So, Dr. Lee, what is the patient platelet count?
Well, this morning it was 24,000.
We can safely start the procedure, but we need to monitor his CBC immediately after after the procedure to see how much platelet we remove. So it would be very helpful if you can send a staff CBC immediately post the procedure. So number one, we can check the efficiency of our procedure to see whether we meet the target of remove about 50% of the white cell count. And number two, we can check whether we need to transfuse him platelets or not. And third, we probably want to check his hematocrit also, because if we go a little bit deep into the layer, we can remove some red cell as well, but we don't expect to remove as much red cell as we remove with the platelet.
Well, out of curiosity, do you use hydroxyethyl starch 6% for your procedure? As you know, AGS can make to enhance the separation of white count from other blood components. Thus, it may increase the efficiency of the procedure and not removing as many platelets as we would like. So many institutions actually use AGS routinely for their procedures. Is that something that you normally do?
Well, again, you point out a very good point that some institutions actually use hexastarch and some don't. I know that Mayo Clinics in Minnesota usually commonly use hexastarch. The institution that usually do not is my institution, UAB, and the institution previously I work at is Columbia. We do not use hexastarch. There is no consensus on whether we should use it or not. And again, you work in the ICU as a physician, you know that it's a volume expander and it's excreted renally. The patient should be evaluated carefully for their cardiovascular and renal status before we give them hexastarch. Also, you know very well that recently a study evaluating the use of hexastarch in many group of patients, and then they prompted the FDA to issue a black box warning that documented the risk of the use of hexastarch. The risks are dose dependent, and it include coagulation abnormality, allergic reaction, pruritus, renal injury, and tissue deposition that can result in organ failure. Although the use of hexastarch in leukapheresis is significantly lower the dose used for the volume replacement in critically ill patients, as the study shown that make the FDA issue this black box warning, the evidence is lacking about the occurrence of those first events associated with the use of this drug during leukapheresis. Actually, it's a very interesting issue. So the Ask for Rare Disease Committee is actually investigating this issue, and they submitted an abstract to the annual meeting to be presented their result in April of this year. So until we get further evidence on this use in leukapheresis and whether they have any adverse event on patients, we will not use hexastarch during the leukapheresis for this patient, just as our protocol. We will not use hexastarch.
Great, thanks for clarifying that. So given the volume change, I would also expect the electrolytes to be affected. Would we also need to monitor that as well?
Yes, you make up a very good point, Dr. Lee. It affects you a certain extent. It's not as huge effect on electrolytes as it did on with platelet count that we worry about and discussed about earlier. Because you know that we have to use citrate as an anticoagulant to maintain the flow of the circuit. We don't want it to clot our machine. And you know that citrate will lead to metabolic alkalosis, and we can lead to hypokalemia, low potassium. So if the potassium is already low to start with, we should give him some potassium supplement. But we also have to balance the risk of tumor lysis syndrome that can leak the potassium out also, and we don't want to make him hyperkalemia. So this is what you call this medicine involved on art and science. This is the art of medicine. You have to give a little bit, not too much, with the potassium level. And you know that citrate also binds your calcium, which can let you hypocalcemia, low calcium level throughout the procedure, and then the patient can have some tingling around the mouth or around the hands, And in pediatric patients, they're most likely to complain of nausea and vomiting and abdominal pain. And if it's not untreated, if it's not treated, it will lead to tetany and could be a seizure and cardiac arrest. But because this is a long procedure for pediatric patients, we run very slow. We expect this procedure to last 3 to 4 hours, if not longer. Then we will give the patient some calcium drip to help to alleviate the sign and symptom of hypocalcemia. We will be monitor this critically ill patient very closely with those symptoms.
So what other adverse events should we be aware of?
So our nurse will be there to throughout the procedure, and then we will be there also to help in case any adverse event happen. And I'm very appreciate that you're present there as well. And it's an apheresis procedure. So in addition to complication from the underlying leukemia that the patient already have, like bleeding and leukostasis, adverse event might include it, but not limited to hypotension. If the patient gets some hypotension or gets some lightheadedness, we can increase our albumin drip rate to balance that with the blood pressure. Citrate-related toxicity, as we said above, we can increase the calcium drip rate, bleeding and infections and things like that. The patient also might feel cold during the procedure. We can give the patient some warm blanket.
Well, we're really hoping that only one leukapheresis procedure is required. We will also start this patient on hydroxyurea, which will help with keeping his weight count down. We understand that therapeutic leukapheresis is not a curative procedure, well, because the reduction of the weight count achieved is relatively short-lived. It is only a bridging therapy in addition to other definite treatments such as chemotherapy. The hemons team will decide on chemo shortly to prevent the rapid reaccumulation of white count and blasts. For MT, however, we believe that the symptomatic leukostasis treatment can be performed daily or as needed to treat given his high white count and signs of hyperviscosity. We understand that the treatment will be continued until his symptoms resolve and or the white count or blast count is less than 50 to 100,000 per microliter. Although we know that the white count is a poor correlation with clinical symptoms, thus defining a white count or blast goal is not really optimal.
Yeah, Dr. Lee, I totally completely agree with what you said there, that hopefully we only perform this only one time, and then hopefully hydroxyurea will kick in. It usually takes about 24 hours for it to keep the white cell low, and hopefully that we will be able to help your patients to feel a little bit better after this treatment.
In summary, we have discussed with the parents that the leukapheresis does not appear to be more beneficial in comparison with aggressive chemotherapy and supportive care, and it should be considered in patients with AML and white count more than 100,000, and maybe consider in children with ALL with a white count that's more than 400,000 per microliter, given that these patients tend to develop pulmonary complications with leukostasis in about 50% of them. We also discussed that the leukapheresis may decrease the early death in MT and other leukemic patients with hyperviscosity. However, it does not appear to increase the overall survival.
Dr. Lee, I completely agree with your view that it is a temporary treatment. As you can see, that leukapheresis typically performed in an emergent setting when a leukemic patient come in with signs and symptoms of leukostasis. These usually to be one of your most acutely ill that you will treat during your career in the middle of the night. So it's very careful. It's very important that that all of us are on the same page of both the risk and the benefit of this treatment and how we handle all of the blood volume calculation, the fluid balance, electrolytes, and priming the machine. And then it's not a common procedure, so it's very important for us as a transfusion medicine and apheresis specialist to maintain the competency of our nurse to make sure that they are always prepared for a case to come, because for a large institution, we might see 10 cases a year. So it's very hard to maintain competency, but it's very important for us to make sure that our nurse will be able to do this procedure comfortably, because this cannot wait. And for local freezers, we usually process about 2 blood volume to remove about 30 to 60% of the white cell count. And we need to monitor the patient potassium calcium level prior to the procedure. And after the procedure, we need to do a CBC to make sure that we achieve our goal of reducing the white cell count, and that we have not removed excessively the platelets or the red cell during the procedure. For adult patients, saline alone may be able to maintain the patient blood volume throughout the procedure, but for pediatric patient, as your patient, we prefer to use albumin to maintain the blood volume. Dr. Lee, thank you very much for telling us about an educational case to help our listener to know how to handle this very, very complicated procedure, as well as how to treat this patient acutely in the middle of the night. Thank you, Dr. Lee.
All right, thanks for having me.